knowing he wouldn't have the energy or the concentration to do anything but look out the window and think. He didn't want to see the thing bloom in front of him again. What scared him was letting his mother do things by herself. He thought they ought to do everything together, for a while at least, no matter how bad. He thought that sometime later they would probably try being apart. He didn't say any of that, he only nodded, and Trudy put the truck in gear and drove them to Brenston's funeral home, where he sat beside her and listened as she explained what she wanted. In the half-light, his mother laid her hand on his shoulder. "Breakfast?" she said. He sat up from the sofa and rubbed his eyes. "How much did you sleep?" he sighed. "A little. Come on." Almandine stood and stretched and followed Edgar's mother into the kitchen. Edgar climbed the stairs to his room and dressed and looked out the window at Almandine, wandering the yard looking for a place to urinate. He walked down the stairs and stepped onto the frigid porch in his socks and pushed the door open. Overhead, a vault of watery blue, Venus and the North Star captured within. Almandine backhanded a paw of powdery snow and stood three-legged, looking at him, jaw hanging gaily. "Come on," he sighed. "It's too cold." She looked around while he shivered, then mounted the wooden steps. He dropped his hand onto her back as she passed. In the kitchen, she shook the cold from her fur and devoted herself to drinking water in loud slurps. The thermostat clicked, and the furnace began to blow. Edgar took a cup from the cupboard and walked to the Mr. Coffee sitting by the stove. He poured until the cup was half full and lifted it to his mouth. He must have made a face. "Fill it with milk," Trudy said. "Use lots of sugar at first." "Okay." He sat, and they waited for the sun to rise further. After a while, Trudy scrambled eggs and made toast. "Will you cut the fence this morning?" she asked over her shoulder. "Where we talked about? We need a path to the birches so they know where to plow. Do it first thing. I don't know when they'll be here." In the workshop, he tested the fencing pliers on a nail, squeezing the handles until the halves clinked to the floor. He hooked a training collar over his gloved fingers and pulled tinder out of his pen. He slipped the loop over the dog's head and heeled him onto the dusting of new snow, so weightless it flew from beneath their feet. The road had been plowed in the night. There were no cars coming. They would have seen them or heard them in the distance anyway, but there never were. At the top of the hill, he stopped and gave Tinder a chance to finish in a sit. When the dog walked past, intent on something in the distance, he reversed. They did this twice before Tinder sat by Edgar's knee. Then he released the dog and they waded to the fence. He pulled the pliers from his pocket and cut the barbed wire and spiraled the ends back along the fence, and they broke a path through the calf-deep snow. The sun glazed on the drifts, cracked into plates underfoot. On the way back to the road, Tinder threw himself down and pedaled with his legs and dug his snout beneath the snow, turning a daft eye on Edgar. "What is it about this weather?" Edgar sighed. "It's making all of you crazy." In the end, he had to kneel and set his mouth by the dog's ear and make words with his lips before Tinder would let himself be guided to his feet. Once up, the dog reared back and did a little canter in place and bit the lead and tossed his head. Edgar sighed and waited. 10 steps further, Tinder began all over again. This time Edgar gave up and unsnapped the lead and half-heartedly pitched chunks of snow for Tinder to leap at while the dog dashed through figure eights in the field with ears laid back on his skull and tail straight behind, turning so madly his hindquarters slung to the ground. When he'd run out his lunacy, he trotted back. By the time they'd returned to the barn, Tinder was healing without flaw, and when Edgar stopped before the Dutch doors, the dog dropped into a perfect sit at his knee. A snow-bladed truck passed their driveway, paused, backed up, and turned in. In the cab sat two men, knit caps on their heads and collars turned up. The driver stepped half out of the cab and leaned over the top of the door while Trudy explained what she wanted.
"Shut the door, for crying out loud,"
the man in the passenger seat said. He was much older than the driver, who waved his hand as if to shoo something away and kept talking. The older man leaned over and pushed the driver out and slammed the door. The men backed their truck up the driveway, gearbox whining. The older man was giving directions, much to the other's annoyance. Up on the road, Edgar and Trudy climbed into the truck's bed. When they reached the spot where Edgar had cut the fence, Trudy tapped on the cab's back window. The driver put the truck sideways on the road, and the two men produced a pair of snow shovels to clear the plow mound. And then they drove through the cut fence, exposing a swath of honey-colored hay. The truck rounded the birches and turned back up the hill. Halfway to the road, its chain tires lost purchase, and they backed down and tried again. They made a second pass and then stopped the truck and stood, stamping their feet and clapping their hands, while Edgar's mother explained what was to be done next. The two men worked that morning with picks and shovels. Their argument carried over the field like the squawking of geese. In the afternoon, the truck trundled down the driveway again, and the men came onto the porch, bickering in hoarse whispers. Trudy opened the door. The men walked into the kitchen.
"Ma'am, there's a problem," the older man said.
"What is it?"
"That ground is harder than concrete. We can't dig in it with the tools we've got."
"Of course it's hard," his mother said. "It's the middle of winter. It's frozen. When we talked, you said you'd done this before."
"Not in the winter. Not in ground frozen that solid."
"You've never done this in the winter."
"The fact is, we mostly do plowing. The occasional odd job, but mainly plowing. We've only serviced a few, home burials, and those are in the summer."
"Then why on earth did you say you could do this?"
The older man nodded, as if this question were exactly his.
"I didn't. My idiot son did."
He glared at the younger man, who raised his hands speechlessly.
"I'm real sorry. I wanted him to call you when I found out, but I let him talk me into trying. Said we could break through the frost. I was stupid enough to go along, but it's like digging into an iron plate."
"So what do we do?"
The two men stood and looked at her.
"We have a burial tomorrow," she said. Edgar could see she was getting angry. "We're going to bury my husband. This isn't a problem I want to have to solve. Do you understand that? Did either of you spend a second thinking about what would happen if you couldn't do this?"
The older man shook his head and said,
"Ma'am, I can't apologize enough. Whatever kind of equipment it takes to break ground like that, we don't have it."
They stood there for some time. Edgar stood behind the men, and he could see his mother's face as she appeared to them, frightening and regal at the same time.
"We could build a fire," he sighed.
She frowned, then looked back at the men.
"You can't do it."
"No, ma'am. The folks at the cemetery must have something. Maybe they could help out."
"Okay," she said. "Follow me."
She tore her coat from the hook and walked out the door, and in the waning afternoon light led them around the corner to the woodpile.
"Here," she said, "I want you to load this into your truck and take it out to the field. Every stick. Edgar will show you where the wheelbarrow is. Then I want you to go into town and go to Gordy Howe's place and get another truckload and bring that back. I'll call him now."
The old man scratched his head and looked at her.
"Will it be enough?" she said.
"Yes, ma'am, I think it will be. It might take some time even then, but I believe that'll do it."
"And will you help?"
The old man smiled and nodded.
"Oh, we'll help, all right. We'll be here until the ground is thawed."
He turned to the younger man.
"Won't we?" he said. "Son?"
All night the fire burned in the snowy field. Streamers of sparks rose every time the men tossed another log onto the blaze. The birches towered orange over it all. Even the barn was painted by the light. Edgar and his mother watched from the living room. Edgar thought of the bonfires Schultz had lit to incinerate the great piles of stumps and roots. Twice they carried food and coffee out to the men. His mother had knocked on the fogged truck window to get their attention. They refused her invitation to warm up inside the house, but took the offering. On the second trip, they brought the men blankets and pillows. The cordwood was heaped between the truck and the fire, and the blaze occupied a rectangle at the base of the birches. Bare, wet grass surrounded the flames. Edgar's mother walked to the fire and peered into the embers. He joined her. Heat scalded his face. When the smoke drifted back, his mother coughed but stood her ground. Edgar breathed it in, feeling not the slightest tickle. They made beds in the living room for the third night and watched the glow from the field. Neither could sleep. They talked between long pauses. "I'll take the chair tonight. You have the couch?" "No, I like it here." "What were you looking for back there?" "Where?" "In the fire. It seemed like you were looking for something." "I don't know. I wasn't looking for anything." She changed to sign. "Can I ask you a question?" "Yes." "Are you scared?" "Because of the funeral?" "Because of everything." "No, not scared. But I didn't know it'd be like this." "Neither did I." They watched the orange firelight play against the limbs of the apple trees. "Do you think it'll work?" "Yes." "I like that the ground will be warm." She looked at him. "I'm very proud of you, you know. Aren't you supposed to tell me everything's going to be okay?" She laughed quietly. "Is that what you want me to say?" "I don't think so. I don't know if I'd believe you if you did." "Lots of people are going to say it. I'll say it too if you want me to." "No, don't." They were quiet, just looking out the windows. "Do you remember anything about your father? Your real father, I mean." "No, not a lot. He wasn't around much." She paused, then shifted in her chair to face him. "What are you thinking? You aren't worried about going into a foster home, are you?" "No." "Good, because that's not going to happen. Nothing is going to happen to me or you, for that matter." "Anything can happen, though." "Anything can happen, but almost always just normal things happen, and people have happy lives." "Were you happy before you met him?" She thought about that a moment. "I don't know. Sometimes I was happy. As soon as we met, I knew I was unhappy without him." "How was it you met again?" She smiled. "In a good way. You'd only be disappointed in the details." "You aren't ever going to tell me, are you?" "I will, if you have to know." He thought then about all the stories his parents had drawn out, how his father, usually so serious, had enjoyed the game of it, and how that made him enjoy it, too. To know that one story was truer than all the rest might make it as if those moments had never happened. And perhaps it was better if they'd met many times in many circumstances. "No," he signed after a while. "Don't tell me." He motioned toward the orange blaze in the field. "Should we take anything else out?" "I think they're getting on just fine." "Good night, then." "Good night," his mother whispered. After that, they were quiet. In the chapel, there was the casket in the front, and from the moment he saw it, Edgar stopped remembering things in order. The drone of the minister's sermon, candles burning, Dr. Papineau sitting with them up front. At one point, he turned to view the mourners, 30 or 40 scattered throughout the pews. Claude's was not among the faces he saw. Afterward, they sat in Dr. Papineau's car and followed the hearse along the main highway onto County C, turning at last up Town Line Road and passing through the overhang of trees. They stopped where Edgar had cut the fence. Glenn Papineau was one of the pallbearers, as was one of the men from the feed store. In all, a dozen of them walked across the field. Graveside, the man from the funeral home began to speak. Snatches rang back from the barn, as if endorsing only a fraction of his words. Then a pair of headlights flickered through the bare trees. A car came to a stop, and Claude appeared at the path entrance. More cars and pickups began to appear in a long line. The proceedings stopped, and everyone turned. Doors opened, slammed. Voices rang tinny in the cold air. Claude waved someone along. A man leading a dog. It was Art Granger and Yonder, both limping with arthritis. Then Mr. and Mrs. McCullough with Hayes, the third sawtail dog their family had owned. Then Mrs. Santone with Deary. Then a lone woman with her dog, a curve of slack in its leash. A young couple with a boy and their dog. The dog's exhalations plumed whitely over their heads as they came down the field. For a long time, people kept appearing at the top of the path, trainers who had adopted yearlings, men whose voices had sped across the telephone lines in conversation with Edgar's father, and Claude directed them along. There was a man Edgar recognized from Wyoming, another from Chicago, but most were from around that countryside, from homes that looked after sawtail dogs. Claude stayed on the road and directed them all down the path until the last of them had passed and they all stood in long, arced rows around the birches. Edgar looked at the dogs and then across the field at the house. Trudy wrapped her arms around him and whispered, "No, please stay," as if she thought he meant to run from it all. But she misunderstood and he couldn't explain. He twisted away and crashed through the snowdrifts toward the house. No sound but the roaring in his ears. Twice he fell and pushed to his feet without looking back. When he swung the kitchen door open, Almandine stood waiting for him. He knelt and let her chest fill over and over in the circle of his arms, and together they returned to the birches, Almandine stepping along in the path he'd broken through the crusted snow. When they reached the rows of people and dogs, Almandine pushed ahead, passing through the ranks until she stood graveside. Then Edgar walked up and put his arms around his mother, and they surrendered to whatever unearthly wind it was that howled over them and only them. And Almandine sat in her wise haunches down beneath the birches, and together they watched the casket descend. They'd brought with them pies and casseroles, sliced cheese and ham, bowls of black and green olives and sweet pickles, miniature slices of bread fanned like playing cards next to saucers of mustard and mayonnaise. People milled around Edgar and Trudy, murmuring reassurances, pressing hands on their shoulders. Almandine passed through the crowd, quietly presenting herself. Many of the owners stayed outside with their dogs. Claude and Dr. Papineau held leashes so the owners might come in and fill their coffee cups and speak with Trudy. To those who had traveled far, she offered room to stay, but no one accepted. They wrapped gloved hands around coffee cups and walked back outside, stopping to settle their hats before opening the door. Claude took those who wanted into the barn to see the kennel. Husbands began to come in to let their wives know the car was running. The last of the women washed and dried dishes while cars turned around in the driveway, headlights sweeping the living room walls. Someone came asking for jumper cables. The women patted their hands on dish towels and took their coats from the pile on the bed. And then only three visitors remained, Dr. Papineau, Glenn, and Claude. They stood on the back porch in the bluing dusk. Dr. Papineau opened the kitchen door. "We'll take care of the dogs," he said. "Don't argue. Go lie down." Trudy nodded. "When you're done, come get some food," she said. "There's so much left." But afterward, the trio walked up the drive. Two pairs of headlights brightened. Edgar watched the cars pull away. He mounted the stairs and pulled off his clothes and fell into bed with barely the strength to thump the mattress for Almandine. As soon as she'd settled herself beside him, he was asleep. The Letters from Fortunate Fields. There followed, for each of them, good days and bad. And often Edgar's best moments coincided with his mother's worst. She could be cheerful and determinedly energetic for days on end. And then one morning he would walk downstairs and find her hunched at the kitchen table, haggard and red-eyed. Once lapsed, nothing could deliver her. It worked the same with him. Just when normal life felt almost possible, when the world held some kind of order, meaning, even loveliness, a prismatic spray of light through an icicle, the stillness of a sunrise, some small thing would go awry, and the veil of optimism was torn away, the barren world revealed. They learned, somehow, to wait those times out. There was no cure, no answer, no reparation. He returned from school one day in March to find his mother working in her bedroom, her hair a sweaty tangle about her head, her breath coming in ragged gasps. She had already closed up the flaps on a tall stack of boxes and was folding a pair of his father's trousers and placing them in another box. Her gaze barely paused on Edgar when he walked in. Later he searched to see what had been lost. The drawer that had once held his father's belts and ties was filled with his mother's gloves and scarves. On top of the dresser, only her sparse jewelry collection remained, and the wind-up alarm clock. She'd even packed away the photograph of her and his father, newlyweds, sitting on the pier in Door County. He woke one morning tantalized by an idea. If he could catch the orchard trees motionless for 1 second, for half of 1 second, if they stood wholly at rest for the briefest moment, then none of it would have happened. The kitchen door would bang open, and in his father would walk, red-faced and slapping his hands and exclaiming about some newly whelped pup. Childish, Edgar knew, but he didn't care. The trick was to not focus on any single part of any tree, but to look through them all toward a point in the air. But how insidious a bargain he'd made. Even in the quietest moment, some small thing quivered, and the tableau was destroyed. How many afternoons slipped away like that? How many midnights standing in the spare room watching the trees shiver in the moonlight? Still he watched, transfixed. Then, blushing because it was futile and silly, he forced himself to walk away. When he blinked, an afterimage of perfect stillness. To think it might happen when he wasn't watching. He turned back before he reached the door. Through the window glass, a dozen trees strummed by the winter wind, skeletons dancing pairwise, fingers raised to heaven. Stop it, he told himself. Just stop. And watched some more. The work to be done was staggering. Simplest was the maintenance of the kennel. Cleaning the pens, feeding and watering the dogs, shoveling snow from the runs, and the infinity of minor repairs on the kennel's mechanical workings. Then there was nursery duty, checking the pregnant mothers, washing the teats of the nursing and weaning mothers, taking the temperature and weights of newborns. For the blind and deaf neonates, there were touch and scent regimes to be followed, neatly penciled in Gar's hand on a yellowing paper tacked to the whelping room wall. For the newly open-eyed, there was a schedule of experiences, from the jingling of car keys to the appearance of an old bicycle horn, which they might sniff until Edgar squeezed the rubber ball and timed how long before they crept back. A patch of carpet to walk on, a tube, a block, sandpaper, ice. The weekly roll and hold until they kicked and yipped, keeping one eye on the second hand of the clock. the sessions with aunts and uncles, learning manners while the mother rested. For everything there were entries on log sheets, milestones checked off, reactions recorded, charts updated, the compiled story of each life. Photographs at 4, 6, 8, and 12 weeks, and then 6, 9, and 12, and 18 months. Frontal, lateral, rear, and orodental on Tri-X. The dogs positioned in front of the painted calibration grid on the medicine room wall. At night there was the house rotation schedule, bringing in pairs or trios, and the pedigree research, and visits by stud dogs, and the heat schedules of the mothers, and the practice placements and negotiations with potential owners. But it was the training that consumed them. The infants needed to learn the simplest things, to look, to listen, to watch, to wait. The 18-month-olds needed finish work and evaluation. And the adolescents, those robbers, thieves, muggers, and bullies who knew exactly what you wanted and devoted themselves to the opposite, needed every spare minute and more. One evening after they had come in from the kennel, Edgar's mother asked him to sit at the table. On a sheet of paper she'd drawn a schedule with columns labeled Edgar and Trudy. "We need to divide up the work," she said. "We're both doing everything right now. I'm not so worried about the nursery. Pearl's an experienced mother, and she won't need much watching. But I am worried about placing them. Your father spent so much time on the telephone. I have a lot of catching up to do." She paused and took a deep breath. "And all that is going to detract from the training. The only bright side to the whole thing is that oldest litter is completely placed. That gives us a few months of breathing room. Then the next litter to go is yours. I don't think they've been spoken for." She looked at him to double-check this. He nodded. His father hadn't broached the issue of placing Edgar's litter, and it wasn't something Edgar had been eager to hurry along. "We have a few months, then. I need to go over the contracts. For all I know, Gar had spoken agreements with people. I hope I won't need to travel. I don't know how we'll manage if I do." She was thinking out loud. He let her go on and sat listening. Then she stopped short and turned to him. "There is another option, Edgar, and we need to talk about it. We can sell the breeding stock and shut down the kennel. After these litters are placed, we would be done. We could probably place them all by the end of summer if we wanted to. We'd have to move into town. I'm sure I could..." He was already shaking his head. "No, listen, we have to consider it. We're going to have to work so hard, there'll be no time for anything else. Have you thought about what that will be like? In a year or so, you'll want to go out for track or football. You might not think so now, but when other boys are doing those things, you're going to resent being stuck out here handling dogs morning and night. What I'm afraid of is that there'll come a time when you hate getting on the bus to come home. And I'll know when it happens." "It won't happen," he sighed. "I don't want to live somewhere else." "That's the other thing. This isn't always going to be your home. In 4 years, you graduate. I can't possibly run this kennel alone, and even if I could, I'm not going to live out here by myself. 5 years, one way or another, doesn't matter much, Edgar. But it matters to me. Besides, how do you know I'm going to leave?" "Don't be ridiculous. You're going to college." "I'm not. I haven't even thought about college." "You will," his mother said. "You need to understand that there are alternatives. You're being closed-minded. Staying here and working dogs might be the hardest thing, not the easiest or the best. As a trainer, you're no great shakes, Edgar. Sleeping with them in the mow doesn't accomplish much, no matter how nice it feels." Edgar felt himself blushing. "It's not so hard to guess what's going on when there's silence up there for hours, and you come stumbling down with straw in your hair. I know how tempting it is. I've done it myself." "You sleep in the mow?" She shrugged, refusing to be drawn off track. "My point is, maybe that's not where your aptitudes lie," she said. "Oh, of course you're good with the dogs. Quit looking so punctured. Your worst quality as a trainer is your pride, Edgar. If we're going to make a go of this kennel, you're going to have to learn so much more. You're going to have to take it seriously. You only understand the basics. Until now, you've been training pups and helping your father. Training yearlings is much more exacting. I can't handle them and do all the rest, too. It's impossible. But I want to learn. I can help. What if I said I wasn't sure I could teach you what you need to know? You can. I know you can. I've been watching you all my life. Yes, you have. So why, at the age of 9 months, does Tinder bolt whenever he gets the chance? That's not fair. Who said anything about fair? His mother's voice cracked a little on the word. He could guess her thoughts. How exactly might the word fair apply to any part of their situation? Furthermore, what she'd said about his training skills was true. He was lazy and indulgent. What he liked was the attention of the pups, not the training. He was inconsistent. He worked with them on skills they already knew and avoided more difficult things. Worst of all, he understood there was more he should be doing, but he had no idea what it was, and that made him feel ashamed. You need to realize that this is a business, like a grocery store or a gas station. You're going to find out that's an awfully cold-blooded view. You're asking to be a partner in it. You have to think of this place as a business first, and a playground with dogs second. You're talking down to me, he sighed. I know what we do. Do you? What do you think we sell? He must have looked at her as if she were insane. Dogs. Dogs, of course. Wrong. You see, Edgar, it's not as obvious as you think. Anyone can sell dogs. People give them away. Do you know what we charge for each dog? He didn't. His father had negotiated these things, and it wasn't something he talked much about. $1,500 for a trained 18-month-old dog. $1,500? Yes, she said. Your litter could be worth between $9,000 and $10,000. It's not now, but it could be. How come we aren't rich? She laughed. Because most of that money goes toward food, medicine, and expenses. We reimburse people who take care of the older dogs. If we place 20 dogs a year, which is about what we average, we squeak by. And it's not easy to find 20 people willing to pay that much for an adult dog. Most people want pups, you know. He nodded. Do other dogs cost that much? Some. A few cost more. Litters out of show ring champions. She rolled her eyes when she said show ring. Her attitude about the dog fancy was just shy of total contempt. Almost all dogs cost less, though. Much less. How can we charge so much? That's exactly what you need to learn, Edgar. When you know the answer to that question, you'll know why we can place our dogs at all, much less at that price. You'll also understand what it is we're selling. Can't you just tell me? I could try, but there are no words for some things, Edgar. Let me ask you a question. You've been around plenty of dogs in town. Do they seem just like ours? Different color, different breed, but otherwise the same? Not exactly. Kind of scatterbrained, right? Yes, but they aren't trained, most of them. Do you think that's the only difference? Our pups mature more slowly. Do you understand that? They don't have their first heat until they're 2 years old. And when they're little, you know how frustrating they can be. Look at Essay. We were still working on simple obedience with her when she was 6 months old, long after any mutt would have that stuff down pat. But try doing a shared gaze exercise with one of those town dogs and see what happens. But that's easy. She laughed and stood and turned on the radio to the country western station she liked, and they cleared the table. She hummed under her breath as they did the dishes, but it wasn't joyful. More like a person singing to keep her mind off something else. Before Edgar went to bed, his mother said one last thing. Edgar, think about what we discussed. Give it a while. Then we need to do one of two things. Either we stay and make this kennel work, and that's going to require you to learn Finnish training, or we begin dismantling the kennel. There's no point in anything halfway."
Edgar nodded. It sounded so rational, the alternatives so clear. He knew what he wanted the moment his mother posed her question, and he knew what she wanted him to want, despite her attempt at objectivity. Another life was inconceivable. It would be much later before he'd realize they'd seduced themselves that night. Seduced themselves into believing they understood all the costs and consequences of what they wanted. That no mistake they might make could equal what had already happened. That their calm wasn't simply a veneer. Since they were in town already, Trudy decided they would eat lunch at the Mellon Diner. As soon as they were seated, Dr. Papineau hailed from across the room, and Trudy walked over to him. Edgar sat listening to the lunchtime chatter and looking out the window. In the corner booth, a little girl was staring at him. A moment later, she marched past, whispering in a quiet sing-song, and disappeared into the bathroom. When he glanced back from the window, he discovered her standing beside his booth.
"Hi,"
she said. She was maybe 5 years old, dressed in a blue jumpsuit with a rainbow-colored elephant across the bib, her hair a yellow tangle of ringlets. She leaned toward him confidentially.
"Mama says you can't talk," she lisped. "Is that really true?"
He looked at her and nodded.
"Not even a whisper?"
He shook his head. She drew back and gave him an appraising look.
"How come?"
she said. He shook his head and shrugged. The little girl glanced back at her family, oblivious to her absence, and narrowed her eyes.
"Mama says I should learn some of that from you, but I can't. I tried, but things just come out of me. I said a person who can talk ought to talk. Don't you think that's true?"
He nodded.
"My grandma's like me. Want to know what my grandma says?"
Now, he was sure he didn't know this little girl, and he didn't know her mother or grandmother either. Yet the more he looked at her face, the more familiar it became, as if he had seen it often, but at a distance. He glanced back at the corner booth. Her family didn't have one of their dogs. He would have recognized them at once if they had.
"Well, do you want to know or not?"
the girl asked, stamping her foot on the linoleum. He shrugged again.
"Okay, sure. She says that before you were born, God told you a secret he didn't want anyone else to know."
He looked at her. There wasn't much a person could say in response to a thing like that. He considered scribbling out a note to the little girl. "I could just write it down." But he thought that wasn't her point, and she was probably too young to read anyway. He particularly wanted to tell her she didn't have to whisper. People made mistakes like that, talking extra loud or getting nervous. But the little girl wasn't nervous, not in the least. She acted as if she had known him all her life. She crooked her finger at him. He leaned down and she cupped her hand by his ear.
"You could tell me the secret," she whispered. "I wouldn't tell, I promise. Sometimes it makes it easier if just one other person knows."
At first, the little girl stood wide-eyed and placid. He sat back and looked at her. Then her eyes squinted into crescents, and her thin lips drew together in an angry little circle.
"You don't remember, do you?"
she scolded, and now she wasn't whispering.
"You forgot!"
Edgar's mother, on the far side of the dining room, stopped talking with Dr. Papineau and turned. "Don't look at me," he signed. "I don't even know who she is." Abruptly, the little girl turned and stormed off. She'd taken 5 or 6 steps before she whirled to face him again. She was a terribly dramatic child, and Edgar had a glimpse of what it must be like in her house. She was probably staging little scenes like this all the time, over eating her vegetables and watching television. She scrunched up her face as though thinking through a knotty problem.
"Would you tell me if you did remember?"
she asked finally.
"Yes."
Her expression brightened into a smile. Her face was still oddly familiar, still impossible to place.
Oh, she said. Okay.
Then she skipped away. Before she reached the corner booth, her attention was caught by a baby in a high chair, and she stopped to poke the baby and ask questions when it started to cry.
What was that about?
Trudy said when she slipped into the booth.
I don't know.
Maybe you have an admirer, she said. And for the third time since they'd walked into the diner, he could think of no better reply than a shrug. They worked hard to distract one another whenever they recognized bleakness descending. Edgar pulled Trudy to the kitchen table to play checkers and eat popcorn. One night she snuck his entire litter into the house without waking him. In the morning, when he opened his eyes, 8 dogs lifted their heads to look at him. Edgar opened the Jungle Book and discovered that, for the first time since the funeral, he could concentrate enough to read. And reading was more comfort than anything else. Kaa's hunting. Tales of the Bandar Log. It didn't matter. It touched the old life, the life before. He watched the television for news of Alexandra Honeywell in the Star Child colony, and that too provided a comfort. Yet in the mornings, the front of his ribcage ached, as if someone had dropped an anvil on his chest in the night. The whelping rooms consoled him, also the workshop, despite what had happened there. But it was the row of paint-chipped file cabinets, standing like sentinels against the back wall of the workshop, that drew him most. Atop the cabinet sat a small reference library, Working Dogs by Humphrey, Warner, and Brooks, Genetics in Relation to Agriculture by Babcock and Clausen, Veterinary Techniques for the Farm by Wilson and Bobrow, Genetics and the Social Behavior of Dogs by Scott and Fuller, and, of course, the new Webster Encyclopedic Dictionary of the English Language. The master litter book was there, too, row upon row of ledgered names and litter numbers, one line for every Sawtelle dog, all the way back to his grandfather's time. 1,000 times he must have watched his father run a finger along a page, then snatch an overstuffed folder out of a drawer. Generations of dogs filled those metal drawers. If ever a folder turned up missing, his father said that it was as if they had lost the dog itself. And he would search and search, saying, "These records are it. Without them, we wouldn't know how to plan the next litter. We wouldn't know what a dog meant." The bottom drawers of the oldest cabinets contained a hash of newspaper articles and letters, mostly addressed to Edgar's grandfather. There was a letter from a man in Ohio whose dog had rescued him from drowning. Another from a woman in Washington State described how her dogs had interceded when she'd been attacked by a mountain lion. Some letters were paperclipped to newspaper articles from faraway cities, the Boston Globe, the New York Times, even the London Times. The pattern was clear. His grandfather had been writing to people because their dogs had done something remarkable, something reported in the newspaper. One letter in particular caught Edgar's attention. It was postmarked New Jersey, and the name, Brooks, sounded familiar. He'd read the first few lines before he stood and double-checked the spine of Working Dogs, and then turned back to the letter. May 2, 1934, Morristown, New Jersey. Dear Mr. Sawtelle, thank you for your interest in our work. I'm gratified that Working Dogs is of some assistance and not a futile documentary effort. Unfortunately, I have no plans that would take me to Wisconsin in the near future, as our work demands my presence here. As one who works with dogs, I trust you understand. First, to your questions. We do not attempt to train our dogs to make complex choices between training objectives. Of course, the dogs make substantial judgments many times a day, both in training and in service. But a command's intent is always unambiguously clear. For example, when recalled, the dog should always come. When told to stay, it should always stay. I can think of no benefit in asking a dog to possibly come when recalled. Scent tracking requires a high level of choice-making, but not the kind you've asked about. We are eminently practical in these matters. Our goal is to produce the best possible working dogs, and consequently we emphasize predictability. I would not like to guess whether the choice-making behavior you asked about can be trained for or tested accurately, or whether it's heritable. I have no more efficacious proofing procedures in mind than those you suggest. This whole question of choice between objectives has been a cause for idle speculation on my part the last few nights, and I have even gone as far as discussing it with my colleagues. The consensus seems to be that even if it were possible, there would be little utility in it for service dogs. Second, for reasons I suspect you already understand, we cannot consider an exchange of dogs. The 6 strains that comprise the Fortunate Fields breeding program represent thoroughly researched bloodlines. In order to select a foundation stock of just 21 animals, we examined the pedigree data of hundreds of candidates, cross-indexed against their show and working titles. As a result, all of our dogs have a proven ancestry that has produced both excellent conformation and great success at work. Introducing an unknown into the bloodlines is out of the question. I should also like to offer 2 observations. First, by beginning your breeding program with dogs you found excellent in temperament and structure, but of unpedigreed stock, you have made attaining your objective, and I admit I don't fully understand it, immeasurably harder. While it's true that our selection of German Shepherd dogs was essentially accidental, the choice to begin with a well-documented lineage wasn't. We know, for example, that our dogs have been structurally sound for at least 5 generations. When questions arise about the heritability of some trait, we can contact the owners of ancestors 2 and sometimes 3 generations back. For the goal of producing a scientifically constructed working dog, this is invaluable. Without such information, one might expect that the first 12 generations would exhibit extreme variability in type. To bring order from that chaos, one would have to aggressively inbreed, with the predictable amplification of undesirable as well as desirable traits. I also feel compelled to say that it is breathtakingly naive to imagine creating a breed of dog in the first place. To do so by selecting what you arbitrarily think are outstanding examples, whatever dogs happen to catch your fancy, and crossing them into your line will only result in a jumble and might well create unhealthy or unviable offspring. I warn you against this course. You seem to grasp the principles of heredity, and thus I'm astonished at what you think you might accomplish. You, the canine species, and our society would be better served if you accepted the realities of animal husbandry. Yours is a common vanity, one that every breeder has indulged during a weak moment. But the best of them put such thoughts aside and ask what is right for the breed. I hope you soon do so as well. What you are attempting is, in essence, the opposite of our endeavor, and I cannot recommend it. A blank space appeared in the text, and then the letter continued. Mr. Sawtelle, after finishing the last passage, I set this letter aside for some days, too upset to finish it. I felt I should either write it again with a more civil tone or simply not post it. Though I am no less adamant today, in the interim I found I will be traveling to Minneapolis. This is unusual and unexpected. But if I've read my map correctly, I may have time for a brief side trip on my return, the purpose of which will be to convince you in person of your folly. In addition, as a scientist, I feel some obligation to review your stock, on the remote chance it might be of use to us. I should be traveling about 6 weeks hence, and done with my business in Minneapolis around June 15th. Signed, A.B. The letter was a curiosity. Edgar had read Working Dogs years before and knew that Brooks was one of the original breeders on the Fortunate Fields project. The makeshift library atop the file cabinets held several books on that subject, as well as articles about Buddy, the most famous of those dogs. Fortunate Fields had originated through the philanthropy of a woman named Dorothy Eustace, whose idea was to breed dogs to help humanity, in particular as guide dogs for the blind. An institution called the Seeing Eye had been established to carry that work forward. Fortunate Fields was interesting because guide dogs for the blind needed to be of a special temperament, unflappable, easy to train, and happiest at work. This ruled out dogs that were, for example, unnerved by new surroundings or too laconic to be relied upon for steady work. The Sawtelle family legend, myth, Edgar had always supposed, was that his grandfather had contacted the Fortunate Fields breeders in the early days and that one of them had taken pains to advise him on breeding and training. The story went that the Sawtelle dogs even carried the blood of Buddy. Edgar fingered through the letters. There were several more from Brooks. The next was dated 2 months later. July 2, 1934, Morristown, New Jersey, Mr. Sawtelle. I apologize for rushing off. Your hospitality was more than I should have hoped for. Indeed, more than I should have indulged in. After seeing your dogs, I understand your enthusiasm. However, I must repeat that there is no possibility that we could use them as Fortunate Field stock. Having also seen your records, I understand that the difference between our approaches is one of philosophy, not technique. You are as selective in your way as we at Fortunate Fields. If I am repeating what I already said while visiting, I apologize. Some of it is unclear to me now. I don't think you have much chance of success, though your definition of success is less precise than ours. That may be more sensible, as you've argued, but it is not scientific. And in science, progress is necessarily slow. I also cannot let you ship a bitch here to be bred. Although I am on your side in this matter, my colleagues are unconvinced. However, I tell you the following in confidence. A gentleman named Conrad McAllister has been living with a dog of ours, Amos, just outside of Minneapolis, for 2 years now. Amos is a sibling of Buddy's, and every bit the dog she is. We consider Amos to be among our greatest successes, though Buddy gets all the publicity. With my endorsement, I believe Conrad would permit Amos to sire a litter with a bitch of your choosing. I could make sure you have the advantage of our full documentation on Amos, since you would be in a position to appreciate what it meant. Finally, I would like to mention a personal matter, with a desire that it need never be discussed again. Our night at the Hollow, as I believe the establishment was called, culminated in a rather unfortunate, indeed foolish, incident. The young lady you introduced me to has mailed several letters to my home address since then, indicating that she would rather not put the event into the proper perspective. Rest assured, I have determined that this is only a matter of misplaced affection and not something medical in nature. I believe you know her, if my memory of that night was not completely destroyed by whatever was in those shot glasses. I shall never again hear the name Leinenkugel without some degree of nausea. I am grateful the beverage isn't sold here. In any case, I've suggested to her that the best thing might be a subtle remembrance in the form of a puppy related to the famous Buddy, which she would acquire from you. I've explained to her that this would be Buddy's paternal nephew or niece. But as you well know, those not involved in animal husbandry have little interest in exact filial relationships, and no appreciation of their significance. In any event, if you would agree to make that possible, I would be happy to send Conrad a letter endorsing the mating, and you would have my deepest gratitude. I believe you have undertaken a particularly interesting project, Mr. Sawtelle. If my prior letter seemed harsh, please accept my apologies. Most anxiously awaiting your reply, Alvin Brooks. Postscript. As for naming, I see no reason to call them anything other than Sawtelle dogs, or perhaps just Sawtelles. If they amount to anything besides well-trained mongrels, they will, after all, have been a product of your vision. And then a third letter, postmarked almost 5 years later, November 18, 1938, Morristown, New Jersey. John. I do not share this desire to wax philosophical about the nature of men and dogs. It leads to discussions that are unscientific at best and a waste of intellectual force at worst. You are talking religion, not science. One part of your letter intrigued me, however, your discussion of Canis posturus, the next dogs, as you call them. I am familiar with the theory of the dire wolf, that gigantic ancestor of wolves that trod the prehistoric earth. I, like you, believe that our modern dogs are descended from the wolves of antiquity, perhaps 100,000 years past. As you say, that gives us 3 points. More than enough to plot a trajectory if they belong to the same evolutionary branch of the species. That is, the dire wolf may have been something entirely separate from Canis lupus, an alternative form that natural selection toyed with and discarded. I must make something clear before I go on. You speak of natural selection and evolution as if they were one and the same, but natural selection, the undirected survival of an individual or individuals, is merely one mechanism of evolution, and not the only one. Mutation, for example, is another mechanism, one way in which novelty gets introduced. As you well know, conscientious animal husbandry serves the same function in domesticated animals that natural selection serves in the wild. Yet in geometry, given 2 points, a line may be drawn. Perhaps the same is true in biology. Suppose those 2 points we take are the wolf and the domestic dog. That does imply something else farther along the same line, the next dog, as you like to phrase it. But this is where your thinking goes awry, for along any such biological line, the farther points are not more advanced than the earlier points. They are only better adapted. That is, evolution and sophistication are not necessarily one the same. And so your endless speculation on the nature of Canis posterus, and hence the next small change that will make them better workers, which is my dream, or companions, yours, is futile, since the forces of selection would either have to know in advance what small change is desired, or be able to recognize it when it happens by pure accident. The latter is not a realistic possibility. Mutations occur at an extremely low rate in any population. And, of course, any chance of a specific mutation that would better adapt a dog for companionship, well, it is possible, but statistically unlikely. Which leaves you in the uncomfortable position of speculating on a change that cannot happen unless you already know what it will be, or have the sort of time on your hands that natural selection has. That's the crux of the layman's trouble in understanding evolution. It works on a timescale so far beyond personal experience that one must train oneself to think in eons, not decades. Here at Fortunate Fields, we have carefully defined objective criteria known in advance by which our animals may be measured for fitness. We know exactly which behaviors to select for. Therefore, though our progress must be slow, we are confident it will also be steady. Since you insist on speculating, however, I will say this much. There are limits to what even the most rigorously scientific breeding program can accomplish. Based not only on the foundation stock and the limits of precision we have for measuring the dogs, but on limits that come from within us. Limits, in other words, of our own imagination, and of ourselves as conscientious human beings. In the end, to create better dogs, we will have to become better people. And that, sir, is the last speculation you will hear from me along these lines. There was more in the letter, an exchange of kennel techniques, clarification of older letters. What interested Edgar was how Alvin Brooks had signed the letter. To move such a formal man from that first outraged letter to one in which he closed with affectionately must have taken dozens, if not hundreds, of exchanges. Why had these, of all the letters, been kept? Probably chance, he knew. But he dug back into the file cabinets to see what else he could find, opening letter after letter and setting it aside. It all made him think about their records. The paperwork on a dog didn't end when it left the kennel. At his father's request, new owners sent back letters every few months describing how the dog they'd adopted was getting along. When the dog reached 5 years of age, his father had contacted the owners to fill out another form. And when the dog died, yet another form was filled out, recording the age, cause of death, behavior late in life, and so on. Edgar's father sometimes even called the dog's veterinarian. As a result, the file for every dog expanded over time until it was stuffed with notes, letters, photographs. A litter, Edgar's father once told him, is like an X-ray of its parents and its parents' parents. But an X-ray that takes years to develop, and even then it's faint. The more X-rays you have, the better the picture you get. This made sense. A dog might sire half a dozen litters, each with 6 or 7 pups. That meant 40 or more pups who reflected the qualities of the sire. If, for an extreme example, cleft palates showed up in every litter, meaning pups that had to be put down, you knew that the sire carried a propensity toward cleft palate. Of course, if a sire produced cleft palates more than once, they stopped breeding him, and a red slash was drawn across the dog's folder. Just before the dog left the kennel, it was evaluated one last time. They called this the finish. There were no special tests in the finish, just the same things they'd always tested for, the same exercises, the same measurements. The difference was this time the results were rolled up into a numerical score, representing the dog in maturity. That finish score was the best indication of what its ancestors had passed on, the best X-ray. Once a finish score was assigned, Edgar's father recalculated all its ancestors' finish scores, going back 5 generations. This was how evidence accumulated about how true the dog bred, how reliably it passed on its qualities, good or bad, to succeeding generations. A second number told them how many of a dog's progeny had contributed to the master's score, an index of confidence. When planning litters, the choice between 2 dogs with nearly identical finish scores favored the dog with the highest index of confidence, the one who had been tested most thoroughly. This was a system Edgar's grandfather had worked out and refined, apparently in long discussions with Brooks, and which his father had practiced, modified, and improved. It wasn't a perfect scheme, of course. While the finish score gave an idea of how well a dog fared in testing, there were intangibles to consider. Not temperament, which they broke down into individual behaviors and assessed, and not physical qualities, which were easily measured, but by how the dog combined all these things. For the whole of every dog was always greater than the sum of its parts. Some, for example, seemed capable of inspiration. They clued in on a new way of doing things more often than others. There was no way to measure this. And there was the dog's personality, which was distinct from its temperament. A dog with a keen sense of humor would find ways to make jokes with you and could be a joy to work with. Others were serious and contemplative, and they were good for other reasons. Edgar's father had sometimes grumbled that all he did was keep track of a dog's faults, though what he meant was even the best records in the world couldn't capture the whole of the dog. They could only record what could be measured. And the measuring and testing of the dogs, the follow-up calls and letters, the reassessment of the ancestors of a placed dog, all served to remind his father of a dog's total character. When it came time to plan a litter, the scores and numbers were only a guide. It hadn't been unusual for him to select against the numbers based on intuition. But his father's complaint also pointed to the fact that the records mainly prevented bad pairings, breeding, say, 2 dogs that tended to produce weak fronts. That was the interesting thing about planning a cross. 2 brilliant dogs couldn't be bred if it risked a litter full of stifles so straight the dogs would be crippled by the time they were 5 years old. So the first question about any potential pairing was not how great the offspring would be, but what problems it might produce. Thinking about all this, Edgar began to understand what his mother meant when she claimed not to have the words to describe what made their dogs valuable. Partly it was the training. They spent long hours doing crazy walking, stays, releases, shared gaze drills, and all the rest until the pups paid attention to where they were going and where they were looking. They learned that a certain expression on a person's face meant that something interesting lay behind them or in another room. He'd taken that for granted, but now that his mother had pointed it out, he saw how uncommon this was. So a dog's value came from the training and the breeding. And by breeding, Edgar supposed he meant both the bloodlines, the particular dogs in their ancestry, and all the information in the file cabinets. because the files, with their photographs, measurements, notes, charts, cross-references, and scores, told them the story of the dog. What a dog meant, as his father put it. Sometimes when Edgar got an idea, a whole series of other ideas clicked into place right behind it, as if they had log-jammed somewhere in his mind, waiting for the way to clear. Suddenly he saw how the training, the breeding, and the record-keeping worked together. How the training tested the dogs for their qualities, their ability to learn different kinds of work. That explained the training notes and why the Sawtells had to raise the dogs to maturity. If they placed a pup, they wouldn't know what kind of dog it became. But the Sawtells could compare them because they trained every dog. So it made sense that a dog's finish score could alter the scores of its ancestors, which in turn influenced the dogs used for the next mating. As if every dog had a voice in selecting the following generations. Edgar closed his eyes and waited until he could hold it all in his mind. And once that happened, he wanted so badly to ask his father about it, to be sure he understood things correctly, that it nearly made him cry. But the only way left to him was through the records. And yet, he felt this, but couldn't find the words for it. Something else made the dogs valuable, too. Something that hadn't been among this sudden cascade of ideas. He wished he could read his grandfather's side of the correspondence to understand what he'd meant by the next dogs. No matter how naive or wild-eyed his grandfather might have sounded to Brooks, Edgar thought John Sawtell's vision might not have been so quixotic. He had a feeling, in fact, that it might already have come to pass. Lessons and Dreams. A few weeks after the funeral, after the shock had worn off and some of the kennel routines were established again, Edgar's dreams began. In them, his father did the most ordinary things, walking along the driveway to fetch the mail, reading in his armchair, lifting a puppy in the dim light of the whelping room to take a closer look. Edgar looked for some connection between his last waking thoughts and what he saw when he fell asleep. One night he found himself walking creekside with his father, the sumac and chokecherry green and jungle lush, though he knew, even in the dream, that outside his window the fields lay buried under thick drifts of snow. Then his father turned and said something important. When Edgar woke, he lay still, trying to fix those words in his mind. But by the time he shuffled into the kitchen, he couldn't even remember whether his father had signed or spoken. Trudy peered at him over her coffee cup. "What's wrong?" she said. "Nothing." "Was it a dream?" she asked. "Your father?" Her guess surprised him. He didn't know how to answer. Was she having dreams, too? It seemed possible. Some mornings she looked as fragile as a baby bird. She was trying to shield him.